Hey, it's John Canzano. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Make sure you subscribe. And thanks to all the listeners and all of our sponsors who help make the Bald-Faced Truth the number one sports radio show in Portland. Enjoy.
Initialize sequence. Welcome to the Baldcast, a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth. John Canzano.
John Canzano.
People don't like to hear the truth all the time. You know, people ask you questions, but they don't actually necessarily want to hear the answers.
Love him.
I mean, I like the guy. I listen to him every day.
Canzano, what's going on, man?
He's dead sexy.
I think he does a damn good job.
I'm going to be rooting for this young Portland team, which, you know, is a terrific team. You guys just have a terrific nucleus.
You pay attention to detail. That's why you're so successful.
I just think he's honest. Straightforward and to the point.
You're bringing up something that's probably the average sports fan watching the game didn't pick up on.
I'm really glad to see that someone who speaks their mind is not afraid to tell it how it is.
He's a smart guy. That's my dude, man. Yeah, I know him, man. I let my mother listen to him.
Hate him.
You don't want to give nobody a second chance.
Trump. To represent that as some sort of subterfuge by John Canzano, I would have expected far better.
He just sounds like an egotistical idiot.
He was rude, crude, and wrong.
Love to hate him.
Yo, John, I can't stand you. I can't stand you, but I come back every day to listen to the show.
Bald-faced truth teller.
Who is he to judge?
Well, he can raise your eyebrows a lot.
I was angry. He just got my feathers that day big time.
Now, from the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, here's John Canzano with a Bald-Faced Truth.
This portion of the Bald-Faced Truth is brought to you by High Caliber Millwrights. Need a machinery job done right? Call High Caliber today.
So yesterday's show ended, and I thought we had a really good show yesterday for the most part. I had maybe 10 or 12 minutes where I stunk, but the rest of the show I thought was really good. I thought we had good guests on the show. We booked this show a lot like it's a regional show or a statewide show. We book it like it's a national show. Mike Leach was on the program, and he talked yesterday about Game of Thrones, and he talked about eating grits, and it made me hungry for grits. And then he talked about his team and Oregon State's team. And after the interview was over, and we went over two segments, generally we'll only keep a guest for one segment, but Leach was so good, I asked him if he would stay over, and he did. And if you want to grab a podcast of the interview, you can by subscribing to this show on SoundCloud and iTunes. I say it all the time, you should anyway. But Leach, after the show was over, I left here, I went to the gym after I left here, and I'm in the gym, and I got a text from Mike Leach. And Mike Leach said, "Hey man, really enjoyed the interview. We should do that more often. In fact, I've been thinking about it. You know, we've got good chemistry," he said. And I don't know what you respond when Mike Leach says, "I have chemistry with you." I don't know how you respond to that. And I just said, "Yeah, I really enjoyed doing it. And the grit stuff was funny. And I'm watching Game of Thrones and, you know, all that stuff." And then he came back later and he said, "You know, we should do that more often." Like, he said, "We should have a show together." And I'm like, "You're a football coach at Washington State. How much time do you have to do a radio show?" Like, he was eating his lunch while he was doing the interview. But it got me thinking, like, how much Mike Leach is the appropriate amount of Mike Leach? I'm not sure you want Mike Leach every day talking battle axes and talking about Game of Thrones and talking about grits and pizza. And I'm still disturbed by the fact that Leach sent me a text unsolicited in the middle of the summer with the link to the 10 best pizza places in the state of Oregon and with no description around it. Like, part of me, like the Italian in me, was offended, like, "Oh, because I'm Italian, you're sending me the pizza stuff?" And not really offended. But and then part of me also was like, does he think I eat a lot of pizza? Well, Leach, I think, would be interesting maybe on a weekly basis, maybe on a couple times a month basis. Certainly we have him on about five or six times during the course of the year. But how much Mike Leach would you be able to handle? And there are some people who don't like Mike Leach. He's not for everyone. It's like there are some people who don't like pizza. It's not for everyone. But how much Mike Leach would you want on this radio program? Because I can feel Leach. He knows he's got a good football team. He knows that there's a shot for him to get some exposure and whatever. But I feel Leach going, "Hey, you know, Let me see if I can get in there in studio with you sometime. Let me see if I can come down when I'm visiting my daughter and get in studio. How much Mike Leach do you want on this show? Tweet at me at John Canzano BFT. I think it's more of a cameo thing. Like, I wouldn't want him on every episode of Entourage, but I could see if he, you know, like Johnny Drama, had good lines, occasionally made, you know, popped in and out of scenes. You know, back in the day when Entourage was a big deal, I could see Leach playing a character on a show. But I'm not sure if I want Leach in every episode. And I'm not sure I could, like, I think it's charming him talking about grits. I think it was amazing him talking about Game of Thrones. I was laughing the whole time. I had a smile on my face. Everybody who was here had a smile on their face listening to Leach. But I'm wondering, in hearing Mike Leach on a daily basis, if there would be an exhaustion with Leach that you would reach. Like Bill Walton, same thing. Like, if Bill Walton's talking, I'm going to stop and listen to what Bill Walton's saying. But if Bill Walton is on every day, I don't know that I could take the Bill Walton waxing poetic about riding his bicycle through the streets of Portland and the Memorial Coliseum on the horizon, him talking about his teammates, Jack Ramsey and Bobby Gross.
And he would say, "Bobby, this is you. Run, run, run. I need you, Bobby, to be relentless." And that was Bobby. And it was tough on Bobby, because for all my sins and for all my crimes against humanity, and Maurice, Lionel, we were all there. But Jack, he always took it out on Bobby. And so whenever things would go wrong, he would just, "Bobby, what's going on here?" And you'd throw Bobby out of practice. And Bobby would say, "What did I do?" And Jack would just say, "Let's get going."
Like a little Bill Walton you like. A couple times a year on this show you like. Do you want Bill Walton every day on this show? You don't. You don't want him every day on the show. There would be an exhaustion point. You'd all end up hating him in the end, and the stories would become less cute. But I like Mike Leach, and I will entertain the idea of having more Leach on the show. You check in on Twitter. Let me know how much Leach you could handle, at John Canzano BFT. Some news today on Oregon Live about Oregon State. I want to share that coming up. Plus, we're going to talk about the Ducks game with Wyoming. C.J. McCollum also making a little noise on Twitter. NBA players have been ranked. Here's an NBA player who is complaining about being ranked and offering up the idea that, hey, how come journalists are the only ones that get to do these rankings? It's not that journalists are the only ones that get to do the rankings, CJ. It's that CJ is suggesting that journalists be ranked. Let's rank the top 100 journalists and see how that goes. And to that point, go ahead. Rank the top 100 journalists. Here's the difference. Nobody's going to care who the top 100 journalists are nationally covering the NBA. Nobody is going to care. Nobody's going to give a rip. Nobody's going to read it except the 100 journalists who are ranked. The players might get a kick out of doing it, but I doubt the players understand what good and bad journalism is. Most of them. CJ might have a better clue because at least he's taken some classes, but he has not worked as a journalist. So I often will think, like, hey, what can a bunch of people watching NBA players really know about playing basketball? Like, should the players be ranking themselves? Well, certainly the league does it with the All-Star games. But it's interesting to me that a player would be complaining or bristling at the notion that they're being ranked. Like, it's kind of what you sign up for. And I like C.J. McCollum, but it's what you sign up for when you sign the guaranteed contract. It's what you sign up for when you have the endorsements and you accept, hey, I'm going to be a public figure. It's what you sign up for when you enter that world where you have some celebrity status. You sign up for the fact that if you make news, positive or negative, if you play well or don't play well, you're going to get criticism, you're going to get praise, you're on a public platform, you're on a public stage. So, yeah, you can rank the top 100 journalists if you can. I hope it wasn't a punitive statement that he was trying to make, like, oh, well, I'll show you if you only ranked me or this guy. But to CJ's point, there's interest in his sport in the off season, in part because people are putting these rankings together and going, all right, who are the top 20 shooting guards in the league? Who are the top 20 power forwards in the league? It's what gets you through the offseason, CJ. It's what pays your salary. Yes, it is. Complain about how you're covered on television. Complain about the fact that people are interested in ranking players. Complain about the idea that people are debating, hey, would the Blazers be better off with C.J. McCollum or Damian Lillard as their centerpiece? Complain about that stuff. But while you're doing it, don't complain about the money that you're making. Don't complain about the platform and the fact that you're being promoted through these things and your league's being promoted. I like CJ. I think he's a smart guy. I think he has more to offer than just basketball. But I hope he's coming from a good place when he says that. And he's not complaining about the rankings. Tweet at me at John Canzano, BFT. The news on Oregon Live, Seth Collins could return against Washington State, according to Gina Mizell, who covers Oregon State for the Oregonian. Now, the offense at Oregon State has sputtered for the first three games of the season. They're ranked 92nd nationally in scoring. They're ranked 96th nationally in yards per game. He's their slot receiver. He's had this finger issue. He's now been upgraded to probable today, and he is probable to play against Washington State. He's a firecracker, Jake Luton says in the piece. It is true. And apparently he's in a no-contact jersey out on the field. So he's in this red jersey on the field, and he's been working with the first team. So this is good. This is good that this is another weapon that they have in a offense that has a few weapons. But along with Jordan Villeman, along with Isaiah Hodgins, along with the running backs Ryan Nall, I'm also told by a source at Oregon State that Thomas Tyner, who I guess was limited in practice a week ago, we did not know that. Thomas Tyner back in practice this week and has been working in practice and is healthy. So for those wondering what happened to Tyner a week ago, apparently there were some practice sessions that he didn't go full speed in. And due to one injury or another, he's now back this week, I'm told, working with the offense and should be a part of that. So if you are a Beaver fan, I think you're going to see Oregon State's offense at full strength for the first time this season. And I think, unfortunately, it comes again in a game against Washington State. I'm not sure they can win even if they have three or four turnovers go their way. I think Washington State is just better. Forget what Mike Leach said on yesterday's show. He was lying to you. He told the truth about grits. He told the truth about Game of Thrones. He lied to you about Oregon State and Washington State having the same amount of talent. I'm sure Gary Anderson, who's on today's show, would love to have Mike Leach's senior offensive line. All seniors. I'm sure he would like to have their quarterback. I'm sure he would like to have their wide receivers. They've got stud receivers, stud quarterback, stud offensive line. You could be down three scores to Boise State with 10 minutes to go and win with that team. And Washington State did that. Leave it here, though. We're going to go to Wyoming next. Duck fans, I got something for you. We visit Wyoming next, right here on the BFT Radio Network. All right, what I want to know what's going on with the Oregon Ducks, we talked to our Oregon Ducks experts. Oregon Live, we talked to Gina Mizell about the Beavers. We talked to Andrew Greif and Tyson Alger about the Ducks. Talked to Danny Moran about the Beavers. When we want to talk about Wyoming, we go to Wyoming. WyomingSports.net. Robert Gagliardi is joining us. Robert, thanks for making time for us, man.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
How big a game is this in the sports landscape in your time there?
Oh, it's right up there. You know, it's one of the three biggest games, or at least top five games that I've covered since I've been covering this team for about 20 years, as far as, you know, name recognition, caliber of opponent, just the buzz around the state that's been going on for, you know, a better part of a year. It's huge. You know, they're expecting it's not sold out, but there's only about 500 tickets left, from my understanding, as of this morning. So, just a lot of hype for it and a lot of excitement. And hopefully, the product we see on the field will prove that out.
Is there hype and excitement just because it's Oregon and it's a brand name, or is it because you've got Josh Allen there and people there feel like they have a shot to win this game?
I think it's a combination of both. You know, in 2013, you know, Nebraska came here. And I think it was more of the hype because it was Nebraska. You know, I don't think Wyoming you know, I think, you know, fans kind of hope for the best, you know, keep it close and see what happens. And you know, it was a decent game. Same with Texas in 2009. But, you know, I think the hype of Oregon, and I know, you know, the last season was a disappointment for the Ducks. But look, in 2014, they're competing for, they're playing for a national championship. It's still Oregon. It's still a national brand out there. And obviously the hype with Josh Allen, the season he led Wyoming to last year with 8 wins and, you know, the first bowl game since 2011. So with those, I think it's a very strong combination of both for the hype for this game.
Robert Gagliardi is with us, WyomingSports.net. The early part of the season, any rubbernecking going on by Wyoming as they look over at Oregon's opponents and the scoreboard and maybe even watching Ducks games?
Oh, I'm sure that, you know, some fans are probably doing that. I think, at least from Wyoming's perspective, the team perspective, it's more about the concerns of their own team right now. I mean, this offense, the pro-style offense that Coach Craig Bull runs, is predicated on the run game. And through two games, one against a pretty solid defense in Iowa, and then last week against a very mediocre, and maybe I'm being kind with that, team in Gardner-Webb, you know, they've averaged 62 yards per game on the ground, you know, and that's not, that's not what this offense is based off of, even with a very talented quarterback like Josh Allen. So, they're replacing their leading rusher from last year. They're replacing all their productive, you know, pass catchers from last season. So those are, still works in progress. So I think, you know, I'm sure there's some rubbernecking going on. But I can tell you from Wyoming's perspective, they're more concerned about themselves, at least through the first 2 weeks, than rubbernecking and looking at scoreboards and things like that.
How has Wyoming looked? How has Allen looked?
You know, he hasn't really been too bad, to be honest. You know, Iowa had a pretty good game plan for him to where they didn't want him to beat him deep. And Wyoming's game plan was to kind of throw the ball, you know, along the perimeter and make some untested guys make tackles, and to Iowa's credit, he did that, or they did that. You know, I had 2 fourth quarter interceptions late that hurt, although it was 21-3 going into the fourth quarter. One kind of got this, at least I got the sense it didn't really look too promising for Wyoming to make a comeback, but we've seen that from Josh Allen and this offense last year, where maybe when things didn't look so good, then all of a sudden look what happens. Last week against Gardner-Webb, he was very efficient. Threw for 328 yards, was 22 of 32. It was only his second 300-yard game as Wyoming's quarterback. You know, was very efficient, didn't turn the ball over, got a lot of receivers involved. I'd say he's looked pretty good. But again, you know, you take what Iowa did and then Gardner-Webb, and now you're facing a team in Oregon who's, you know, played well defensively through the first 2 games. Maybe, you know, it'll just be interesting that the speed and athleticism that Wyoming's going to face defensively on Saturday isn't anything, and no disrespect to Iowa, isn't anything it's seen yet this season.
What makes Allen good? What's his skill set?
Well, he's a big kid, 6'5", 230, 240 pounds. He's got a big arm, can make all the throws, and has shown he can make all the throws. He's mobile. He can make things happen with his feet if he chooses to. They've kind of not done as much of that with him early this season. I don't know if that's going to continue, but he's a very mature kid, you know, and I think that's been proven even after last season when a lot of NFL draft hype was coming and, you know, he came close to turning pro, but he decided to come back to Wyoming and improve his skills. Very poised. He's a good leader, but he just, you know, it's just one of those guys. I mean, you guys see Pac-12, you know, I think Coach Taggart said it earlier this week. He's a Pac-12 like quarterback, but also a very good NFL pro prospect, and how that pans out down the road, we'll wait and see. But I know the scouts really like his skill set and they've been coming to Laramie. I mean, they come all the time and you guys know this, where teams have their regional scouts all over the country and they make their rounds. But I would say this year there's been more interest from scouts coming in to look at Mr. Allen.
How did he get overlooked? Because I know he went to Reedley College before going to Wyoming, but how did Josh Allen fall to Wyoming?
Well, he was 185 pounds in high school. So, you know, he, you know, and he had good numbers in high school, but nothing eye popping. And, at Reedley, he only played one season there, and everyone overlooked him. You know, Wyoming was at Reedley at the time looking at another player, and the assistant coach that was there happened to see Josh Allen, you know, went back to the coach and said, you know, maybe you ought to give this kid a look. Wyoming did, and the only other school that offered him at that time was Eastern Michigan. So it wasn't just, you know, so Wyoming maybe kind of got a little fortunate that, you know, they were out there and saw a tall, kind of lanky kid with a big arm with some potential that, that maybe they could develop, and it just worked out. But it wasn't just how he fell to Wyoming. I mean, he fell through the cracks with everybody around the country in junior college.
What would a win over Oregon mean to the Wyoming program and people in Laramie?
Oh, I think it would mean a lot. I mean, you know, it's, again, no matter what happens on Saturday, there's a lot of football left in conference season, you know, to be played. But, you know, again, you know, Pac-12 and Power 5 conference schools don't come to Laramie, Wyoming very often. And, you know, they've had some exciting games with some Power 5 schools in the past, but it's been since 2007 since Wyoming beat a Power 5 conference team at home, and that was Virginia. And let's just face it, Virginia isn't exactly the elite of the elite when it comes to Power 5 conference football. So, you know, I think it would say a lot about this football team. I think it would, you know, continue some momentum of the hype and the excitement for the season to come for this season. And, you know, Wyoming's a small state with, you know, very loyal fans, maybe not a ton, but very loyal. But when the football team is doing well, it just seems like everyone around the state has a little extra kick in their step, so to speak. And a win against Oregon would it would be huge financially for Wyoming as far as just all the people coming in here, maybe give them some more momentum to draw, you know, better crowds as the season goes on. And to just give a state, a smallish state that's very prideful, just a little extra pride moving forward.
Feels like it's that game they circle on the calendar there when that game is made as people are coming in. And I know that I've seen Power 5 conference teams go in against mid-majors and find that they were ambushed, you know, especially a home game. I've seen Fresno State do it. I've seen Boise State do it. I've seen them circle that game and say, that's our Super Bowl in non-conference play. Why hasn't this game sold out?
Well, the only tickets that are left to this point were tickets that Oregon sent back that didn't fill their allotment. I was told that Oregon was given 3,000 tickets, and they've sent back close to around 1,000 of them, maybe a little less. And that number was about 900 as of Monday, and now, like I said, it's down to maybe about 500 now. So I think it's just a matter of, you know, by the end of the day, it could be sold out. But the tickets that were left were tickets Oregon turned back. So technically, from the tickets, you know, through season tickets and just, you know, single game tickets, you know, from the fan base in Wyoming, this game has been sold out for quite a while.
We're talking to Robert Gagliardi. He is with WyomingSports.net. You've been there 20 years in covering this program. How has Wyoming changed, and has it improved its standing when it comes to realignment and where it's positioned right now?
Well, I think it's certainly making improvements. I think the one thing about Wyoming is, and you guys, you know, probably aware of all the realignment work and stuff, and recently when the Big 12 opened its doors to look at possible expansion here, what, last year, a couple years ago, and, you know, a lot of Mountain West schools applied for it. I mean, Arkansas State applied. I mean, you know, it was everyone and their brother was applying for it. But Wyoming knows who it is. It's a public land grant university in a very isolated state as far as population. There's not a big TV market here. It knows what it is, you know, and it does what it can to keep up with the Joneses when it comes to big time college football. You know, it is what it is. It's budgets, you know, they do a lot with less. They do well in fundraising. They have a $44 million expansion on their football facility that'll be ready next summer. You know, they do what they can. They've even gotten state, you know, help from the state of Wyoming government about, you know, matching funds for things like nutrition and recruiting budgets and things like that. I mean, I think it just knows who it is. It's a small school in the West, with a small fan base that's very prideful, and they do what they can. And, try to develop players and student athletes in general. And, you know, it's just, they just plug along and do what they can. You know, are they going to have the biggest budget in the Mountain West Conference? No. Are they going to, you know, play for a national championship? You know, probably not, but they just realize who they are and they do the best they can with what they have.
Robert Gagliardi, WyomingSports.net. Leave it right here. There are a lot of good quarterbacks in the Pac-12. A lot of good quarterbacks. The San Jose Mercury News' John Wilner did a piece on the best quarterbacks in the Pac-12. He talked about in these categories. Here are the three categories. One pass, one game, and one career. So who are the best quarterbacks in the Pac-12 when it comes to those things this season? Like, can I have a guy for one pass, one throw? Can I have a guy for one game? Can I have a guy for their career? Now, Bruce Feldman, reporter for Sports Illustrated and Fox, and the author of the book, The Quarterback, Making of Modern Quarterbacks, friend of this show, Feldman took Luke Falk for one pass. For a game, he took Sam Darnold. And for a career, he took Darnold. Like, Falk is super smart, okay? And Falk on 3rd and 9 or 4th and 6 makes those throws all the time. UCLA's Josh Rosen is the best pure passer. But he took Darnold in game and career areas. A lot of people taking Darnold. Brady Quinn, former Notre Dame quarterback and a 7-year NFL quarterback and who's now an analyst for Fox, he took Josh Rosen for one pass. He took Darnold for a game, and he took Jake Browning at Washington for a career. No mention of Justin Herbert by any of the experts consulted. And I agree with that. Now, Duck fans are going, well, wait a minute. Like, hasn't Justin Herbert done enough to be considered? He certainly has. But you cannot compare him right now to Luke Falk, who has done it at a high level in big stakes games over an extended period of time. We've seen a bigger sample size. Justin Herbert last year for the Ducks, frankly, was competing in a lot of games outside of maybe the Utah game down the stretch where the outcome was out of reach. And I'm not saying he piled up meaningless stats. I'm just saying he wasn't in high pressure situations last year and hasn't been this year either. And the worst throw of his season to this point, for being real, came with the Oregon game kind of getting tight with Nebraska. Threw into double coverage and was an interception. I think Herbert's going to be great by the time he's done. I think the sample size will be big enough where we go, hey, Justin Herbert, where does he rank as a Ducks quarterback? And where does he rank? And I think he'll be in that conversation of, you know, the 15 best quarterbacks to ever play at Oregon or 10 best or 7 best. I think he'll get there. But I think it's way premature with Oregon playing in a handful of meaningless games last year. Frankly, the Washington game is where he made his first start. That game was out of question. They were down 4 scores in every game. The Utah game was the game where you have to go, all right, Herbert showed us something. But his record as a starting quarterback ain't great because of last season. And the sample size this year includes the 2 games that were for 6 quarters, blowouts. And I didn't like I thought his best throw of his career and his worst throw of his career came in the same game, the Nebraska game. I thought the first touchdown pass that Herbert threw to Brendan Schooler was an absolute rope. It was into a tight window. It had to be on a line. He had to be very accurate with it because he not only had to worry about the defender that was chasing, but there was a linebacker cutting in front of the pass. And by the way, you have to worry about the end zone and running out of real estate. And he just dropped it into a perfect spot. Great throw. Had velocity on it. It looked like ribbon sailing through the air. It was like absolutely beautiful. And his worst throw came in the second half against Nebraska. Pressing in a bad situation, double coverage down the field, safety over the top. It just wasn't there, and he tried to force it. And I thought it was a turning point in the second half of the Oregon-Nebraska game. Because it was a situation where I probably wouldn't have gone down the field if I was Oregon. Maybe they saw something they liked pre-snap. But it was a Royce Freeman-type third and short situation. And they went down the field, and it was two or three on one. Didn't like it. So I agree with what the analysts are saying and the quarterback analysts are saying. And it included the NFL Network's Daniel Jeremiah, Fox's Joe Klatt, Bruce Feldman of Sports Illustrated and Fox, and Brady Quinn of Fox. I thought that it was really revealing to hear those guys break down the Pac-12's best quarterbacks. This is the conference of quarterbacks, right? Break down those quarterbacks and not include Justin Herbert as one of the guys. Will that change? This isn't going to be the week to make it change, because I think Oregon, the problem also that Herbert has is Royce Freeman. Because I think no matter how good Justin Herbert is, and he's been great against some really shaky defense in two games. But I think no matter how good he is, always people are going to go back and they're going to be like, well, he's got Royce Freeman. It's the problem that, you know, Hardy had. Laurel. You know, he had Laurel. Everybody went, it's Laurel and Hardy. It's Freeman and Herbert. It's the problem when you've got, you know, George Burns and Gracie. It's George and Gracie back there. And Royce Freeman's George. Batman and Robin. And right now, I think at this point of his career, Justin Herbert, as the complimentary guy, he's going to have to be happy in that role. Royce Freeman is Batman. And Justin Herbert's got to be Robin. And you need Robin, right? Batman needed Robin. Because at some point, you know, in every episode, that Robin was going to bail out Batman. It's like any NBA team needs a Batman and a Robin. If you have two Robins, you're in trouble. If you have two Batmans, you're in trouble as well. If you don't have, you know, balance. Problem is the Warriors have three Batmans, maybe four. But I think at this point of his career, Justin Herbert's going to have to be content to be that other guy and to have a lot of Duck fans who are going, hey, wait, what about him? And I think if there's a point where he could have a breakout, it will come this year. It's not going to come against Wyoming, though, because Southern Utah, Nebraska, Wyoming, it's not where you earn that credibility in the public's eyes, and it's certainly in the national media's eyes, as being a guy that everybody has to account for. Where you get that is in the stretch of the season where Oregon, who unfortunately does not play USC, I would love to see Oregon-USC this season, but they don't play USC this year. But it's going to be that stretch of games where they play Washington State, Stanford, UCLA, Utah, and Washington. Those are Justin Herbert's moments where in that five-game stretch from October 7th to November 4th, those 5 weeks there of Washington State, Stanford, UCLA, Utah, and Washington, that's where Justin Herbert has to step up and lead and carry, because by that point of the season, you're going to have teams that go, hey, look, we're not going to let Royce Freeman beat us. And that's where Justin Herbert, if he's putting together 300-yard games and four touchdowns and passer ratings that are ridiculous like he's had in the first two games, that's where he's going to earn that credibility. He's got a lot of football in front of him. The sample size is too small. And I hear a lot of people saying, well, he should be included in that conversation. I don't think so. I think it's premature. I think he'll get there. He's not done what Jake Browning's done. He's not even done what Sam Darnold's done. And certainly Josh Rosen as a passer is the best pure passer in the group. I think it's an unfair comparison. But hey, for us to be even considering it and talking about it at this point means that Justin Herbert's done something right. So I give him credit there. All right, coming up, I'm going to give you the one thing you need to know in sports today. Then in the 1 o'clock hour, just a few minutes away, Joseph McRae's coming on the show. Who is Joseph McRae? Well, he's the guy who showed up at the L.A. Chargers news conference and flipped off the owner of the Chargers. He's also done something crazy just outside the stadium in L.A. He's rented out billboards. It's a big story today nationally. Joseph McRae is going to be with us to talk about how angry he is at the Chargers and why he's advocating not just on behalf of the Chargers, but on behalf of all NFL teams. He's angry. He's got both middle fingers out, and he'll be here at one. Probably know this, but I'm going to share it anyway as part of our big splash.
The one thing you absolutely need to know today.
Look at it. Where?
Down there.
The big splash. Brought to you by the experts at Anderson Pool Works, who can make a splash in your life. AndersonPoolWorks.com.
All right, the big splash today comes out of Cleveland, where the Indians have set an American League record. They've done it. They've won their 21st straight game today. It sets an American League win streak record. Only two teams in the past 101 years have won that many consecutive games, or they passed those two teams. Jay Bruce hit a three-run jack off Bud Farmer. Mike Clevenger won his fourth straight. Indians beat the Tigers 5-3. That streak matches the 1935 Chicago Cubs for the second longest streak since 1900. They are only five wins behind the 1916 New York Giants, who won 26 straight without a loss. By the way, their mark includes a tie. The Indians haven't lost in 20 days. 20 days! Today they had to overcome an error and rely on their bullpen, but they did it. 29,346 gave a standing and stomping ovation. The Indians have the league's longest streak since the American League was founded in 1901. So there it is out of Cleveland. Pretty good story for the city of Cleveland and for Indians fans and baseball fans who are interested in that. But it got me thinking about the longest streaks in history. Do you know the longest streaks in major sports history? Win streaks? So now you've got the Cleveland Indians trying to chase the New York Giants record of 26 in baseball. They have the American League record now of 21. The New England Patriots hold the NFL record. They won 21 straight games. See, to me, 21 straight in baseball is so much more impressive than 21 straight in the NFL. And by the way, the Patriots streak includes the Super Bowl win over the Carolina Panthers in Super Bowl 38. They went on and won the next Super Bowl, by the way. But they also were 16-0 in a regular season. But this was from 2003 to 2004. They won 21 straight games. That is the NFL record. In hockey, the record for consecutive victories is held by the Pittsburgh Penguins. They won 17 in a row in 1993. That's when Mario Lemieux came back from radiation treatment from Hodgkin's disease. They won every game they played for more than a month. And Lemieux had 27 goals and 23 assists in the streak. Remarkable. Major League Baseball, we talked about the Giants. They did have a tie. And by the way, that tie game was called in the ninth inning against Pittsburgh because of weather. It wasn't like it went forever and they just said, forget it. It was a weather-related tie. The Lakers hold the longest NBA win streak. They won 33 in a row, 71-72. That was a team that didn't lose a game for more than 2 months. Wilt Chamberlain, Elgin Baylor, Jerry West, Pat Riley, part of that group. And remember, the Miami Heat gave it an effort. Miami Heat tried to get to 33. They got to 27. Didn't the Warriors break that? Gliss, didn't the Warriors get more than 33? I think that the Warriors broke that record. Maybe I have some bad information here on my sheet. It's not your fault.
Yeah, I don't know if they actually broke it or not. I feel like they might have come close to that, but
yeah, you know, they had the wins in playoff history.
Okay, yeah.
So the longest win streak in playoff history, they won 15 in a row. They did not get the 33. So the 33 stands. Warriors got to 28, and they did it twice in 2014, 15, and 15, 16. They got to 28 in a row. Does anybody know the Portland Trailblazers' longest win streak ever? I do. What do you think it is?
Is it 13?
Nope. It's higher. 16 in a row. They won in 1990-91.
Okay.
On their way to a 63-19 record in 90-91. And by the way, that in NBA history ranks them 22nd longest win streak among franchises. Pretty cool to have to win that long. In major college football, Oklahoma holds the Division I record for most football wins in a row. Anybody know how many they won in a row? Raise your hand if you know this. 47 straight. They won 47 straight games in the 1950s. They lost to Notre Dame to open the season in 1953 and did not lose again until November of 1957 when, guess who? Notre Dame beat them 7-0. Oklahoma fans, you went 1,500 days without losing a game. That's ridiculous. Shame on you, Oklahoma fans. I have no, like, I changed my mind about this Baker Mayfield thing at midfield now. Because everybody's like, who, you know, what was the thing you asked me yesterday, Brandon, to ask Siri? What's going on with that?
Ask Siri who owns Ohio Stadium.
And what happens when you do that?
It pops up and says Baker Mayfield does.
He owns, because he planted the flag at midfield. That's pretty cool. Baker Mayfield, though, I changed my mind. That was poor sportsmanship. Because if you win that much, you're just snobby in college football. I would have thought Alabama or somebody owned that, but I guess if you're playing in the SEC, it's tough to have a win streak of that long. By the way, in college football, overall, that is not the record. That's Division I college football. But Mount Union, Division III, Mount Union, which is in Ohio, had a dynasty that will probably be never matched in college athletics. They won 54 in a row from 1996 to 1999. Okay, that's pretty impressive. Then, after losing a game, they promptly broke their own record by stringing together 55 more consecutive wins. They then went on a 110-game regular season win streak. 110. They are now in the midst of a 93-game win streak again. They got to play somebody. You may know men's college basketball win streaks. Again, we're talking about win streaks. John Wooden's UCLA Bruins won national championships in 64, 65, 67, 68, 69, 70, 71, 72, 73, and 75. But they had 88 straight from 1971 to 1974, and that was broken in the state of Oregon, as people may remember. UConn women won 90 in a row. That's a win streak. De La Salle High School conquered De La Salle in the Bay Area. They won 100. They became the first high school team to win more than 100 games in a row. They won 151 in a row. To put that into perspective, George Bush was president when the streak began. And then the other George W. Bush was president when the streak ended. And many of you may know the movie, When the Game Stands Tall. That is the De La Salle movie. But that doesn't top the greatest win streak of all time. Who holds the greatest win streak of all time across all sports anywhere?
Does it have to? You're talking about just consecutive games?
Consecutive games won without a loss. Don't look it up. Tell me who won more games than anybody.
What about the UConn women's team from this year? They won, what, like 110 or something like that before Final Four?
I thought they were at 90 or something, but let me look at that. But before they lost in the Final Four, 111. So 111. That's not the record. What's the record? Think of all sports, across all sports. Who has the greatest win streak of all time? And here's the thing. The win streak was 2,495 games without losing until it was finally broken. Got any thoughts on that? Come on.
That's a big number. I'm totally blanking right now. Like, to even think that someone could win that many games.
It also coincides with the greatest losing streak of all time.
Is this an individual or is it a team sport?
Team. Okay. 2,495 losses for their opponent. Who are they?
Globetrotters.
Yes, the Washington Generals against the Globetrotters. It lasted. By the way, 1971, they lost. How pissed would the Globetrotters be? Like, dude, you're supposed to show up here and lose. How pissed would you be that you won the game? Bob in Portland's got a correction. What's up, Bob?
Well, John, maybe I misunderstood you, but you said that the UCLA win streak ended in Oregon?
Let me look that up.
No, Notre Dame beat them. Digger Phelps.
Oh, you're right. I was thinking they came to the state. I thought they came to the state of Oregon, but you're right. 71-70. You're right about that.
Yeah, you think of the lost weekend, but that was something.
Yeah, that's something different. You're right. Thank you for that.
Okay.
Listeners are too smart for me. It's right. It was an 88 game win streak. He's right. He lost it 1971. By the way, it started against Notre Dame and ended against Notre Dame. That win streak. Sam in Salem, quickly, Sam, go ahead.
I wanted to talk a little bit about Mike Leach from yesterday.
All right, hold that thought. Hold that thought. Hold on for a couple minutes. I'll get you right after the break. How about that?
Perfect.
All right, here he is. After the break, we'll talk to him and a very angry NFL fan. Leave it here.
Something is about to happen.
BFT.
Now listen up, everyone.
Let's go. The Bald-Faced Truth.
John Canzano.
I gotta say, I love him most of the time. I think he's right on.
He's okay.
John's great.
He's a little unusual.
Live every afternoon, 12 to 3 p.m.
I hate that guy because he just never knows what he's talking about.
I think he does a damn good job.
That's my dude, man. Yeah, I know him, man. I let my mother listen to him.
Now, from the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, here's John Canzano with a Bald-Faced Truth.
This portion of the Bald-Faced Truth is brought to you by High Caliber Millwrights. Need a machinery job done right? Call High Caliber today.
Thank you, Alabama Adriana, for that read. We've got Joseph McRae, who is a ex-San Diego Chargers fan, who's coming on the show. Sam in Salem has been holding, too. He wanted to tell us something about yesterday's interview with Mike Leach. Sam, what's up, man?
Okay, so I got two things for you. One about the Pac-12 Network, but I got a great Mike Leach story. So thanks for holding me over. So I'm a Duck fan, and it's the day after the national championship game. We just lost to Auburn. I'm at Sky Harbor in Phoenix. I'm heading home, and I'm waiting. I look over in this little store, and I see Mike Leach. And I'm thinking, okay, I'll approach him. So I walk up to him, and I said, hey, Coach, not really a Texas Tech fan, but I respect what you did down there and knowing the parties involved. It sounds to me like you kind of got a raw deal, and I hope you get another chance at coaching. And he put his hand right on my shoulder, looked me squarely in the eye, and said, much sincerity, how much he appreciated me approaching him and mentioning that to him, and went on to say about how great of a team we had and how much he appreciated the Ducks and Chip Kelly, and it was a great moment.
Yeah, you know what? I find him to be candid, authentic. Some people don't like him. I like Mike Leach. I think he's a smart guy, and I think he can talk about more things than just football. I want to talk about more than football, too, with our next guest, Joseph McRae. He's getting called the San Diego sign guy because he's done something interesting. He's angry. He's angry about the Chargers leaving San Diego. I know a lot of people who are angry. There's a police officer in my neighborhood who is angry about it. He grew up in San Diego, and he refuses to watch the Charger games. I'm bringing on Joseph McRae now. Joseph, welcome to the show. Thanks for making time for us.
Of course, man. It's a pleasure.
Now, give us an idea of, like, how big of a fan are you when it comes to the Chargers, or were you?
Oh man. Season ticket holder for 15 years. Haven't missed a game in 25 years. I could name you the starting lineup or the starting offensive line for the 2006 Chargers when LT won the MVP. I could tell you about the 2001 team that won one game. I mean, I'm a diehard fan, diehard as you get.
When it turns out that, you know, the Chargers are a threat to leave San Diego, you must be pretty worried at that point.
Well, I mean, it's just about where they're going. It's to Los Angeles. Now, people that are not, you know, live in San Diego, that are not aware, but San Diego and Los Angeles, we grew up hating each other's sports teams. That's how it is, you know. Out there, I'm sure you know how it is if you have a rival. But basically, I grew up to hate Silver and Black, the Raiders in Los Angeles, and I grew up to hate Dodger Blue. That's what I was accustomed to. Now you're telling me that the team that I love so much, more than the Padres, is going to move to Los Angeles and be a part of the LA sports? I mean, it killed me. It really did. It killed me.
You've been a fan your whole life, and this team gets taken away. So at that point, a lot of Charger fans go, okay, you know, I'll root for them anyway, or I'll find another team to root for. You've gone further. You also launched a GoFundMe campaign. How did the GoFundMe campaign go?
Well, it was going it went well. We hit our goal. We hit $10,000. We hit our goal about a couple weeks ago, and it was to get a billboard up in Los Angeles to have basically anti-NFL billboards, anti-Dean Spanos. I mean, the NFL also allowed them to move, in a sense. So yeah. I definitely believe that there is blame to go along for everybody.
That's the news today. The news, the headline is that a disgruntled fan has bought anti-NFL billboards for the Chargers homestand. How many billboards did you buy, and what will they say?
Well, okay, so my goal was to get 3, but then I was told by the billboard company in Los Angeles that I've been working with, who are also not a big fans of the Chargers owner, Dean Spanos, they told me that billboards along, because the StubHub Center is located in Carson, the biggest freeway next to the StubHub Center is the 405 South, so that was my target the whole time. 405 South is one of the busiest intersections in Los Angeles. And they told me that the Chargers and the NFL were starting to purchase billboards. So I had enough money to purchase one digital billboard on the 405 South right before you exit to get to the stadium. And I have 5 images because it's a digital billboard. Now, I put them up on Twitter. There are 5 images. 3 of them are at Dean Spanos, and 2 of them are at the commissioner, Roger Goodell. If you watch the Patriots in the Chiefs game last week, you saw the clown noses that a bunch of fans made. Well, I took that logo, I put it on the billboard, and if you know how the NFL is with this whole football is family down your throat, well, if football was family, then you relocated 3 teams in 1 year. So, again, you're telling me football is family? So I took their slogan, I took football is family, and I crossed out the family with dollar signs. And then I put San Diego, Oakland, and St. Louis because we're all victims of losing our teams.
Our guest is Joseph McRae, former Chargers fan. I say former because they leave San Diego, and he has been left in the cold without an NFL team there. If I'm the Chargers, I would have reached out to you really early, Joseph, and I would have said, look, here are the realities of it. Try to bring you into the fold. Try to help you and some other Charger fans in San Diego understand, because I think they're going to need you guys to travel and go to games.
Well, you know, that's the thing. You would think this, but we're not dealing with an ordinary owner in the NFL. We're talking about Dean Spanos, the man who let Rodney Harrison walk away, the man who let Junior Seau be traded, allowed to be traded, the man who released LaDainian Tomlinson, the man that allowed Marty Schottenheimer to be fired after going 14-2. So we're talking about an owner who doesn't really know what he's doing, first off, right? And second off, for me, it's just the way they've handled this move. Now, I have been following this like crazy. I mean, we've been talking relocation here for about 5 years. I follow it religiously. I was doing my part. I went on, knocked around doors, talked about the stadium initiative that's going on. And, you know, in this time, after they've moved, you know, the Chargers haven't done anything here in San Diego to apologize or to do anything whatsoever to keep us on tack. Like Mark Davis, when he's relocating the team to Vegas, you know what he did that night? He went down to Oakland and he had an open forum meeting and talked for about 3 hours with Oakland fans who were pissed, who were mad at him. He took it like a man. He did the right thing by reaching out to his fans and saying, I understand your frustration. Come talk to me. We're Raider fans at the end of the day. You know what Dean Spanos did? He sent a letter and left. He sent a lousy letter, like three paragraphs, says, hope you understand, bye. Nothing at all that was remotely sincere. It's one thing if you handle it like Dean Spanos, but then you see Mark Davis handle it like a true businessman and also just a reasonable human being.
You went to the news conference or the rally that they held in Los Angeles at the Forum in Inglewood, and this kickoff rally, Spanos shows up, and I love this. You show up and heckle him. And how did that go down, and how what made you decide to do that?
Well, again, I have been a fan my whole life, and the way that he left San Diego was disgraceful. And then also his son goes on public radio making fun of the Qualcomm Stadium and saying how StubHub Center is going to be such a better fan experience. After his son said that, I was like, okay, how can I get back at these guys? So they had a pep rally. I was a season ticket holder, so I did receive an email inviting me to it. But by the time I RSVP'd to it, it was too late. They said it was full, and I knew that they're not popular in Los Angeles. There's no way this forum, this pep rally, can be full of hundreds of Charger fans. There's no way. So I drove to Los Angeles. I got in somehow, some way. I got to the front, and when I was there, no one was there. I would say there's about 150 people that were there, and it was so crazy for me because these fans in Los Angeles, they were chanting L.A. Chargers and clapping, and this is all new to me. You know, I'm not used to hearing this, so it was so weird being there.
Did they escort you out? Did the police come and escort you out?
I got escorted out by security after. See, what I did is I waited the whole time. The commissioner talked, one of the Rams guys talked, a bunch of suck-up L.A. media, Dean Spanos people talked. And then once Dean Spanos talked, that's when I heckled him. That's when I was going after him. And there's one funny thing about this is that Dean Spanos, when everyone came up to the podium to speak for about a minute or 2 minutes, they all spoke from the heart. Easy words to say. This is not a crazy, you know, you should be able to just talk in front of your fans. Well, Dean Spanos went up with note cards, and he had to read with note cards, which was embarrassing. And so as he was reading, I heckled him, and he stuttered on his words, and he kind of got a little shooken up by it.
Yeah, he's not used to that.
Media,
yeah,
he's not. You know, the one thing I realize about living in San Diego, Dean Spanos is not like public criticism. He hates it. He hates being the center of attention. But he's an NFL owner. He's a public figure in California. It's just you're up for this. And so
did he block you on Twitter? Did he block you?
His son John Dean Spanos blocked me on Twitter. And you know what's funny is that he's actually blocked about like 100 of us, like diehard Charger fans.
Yeah.
He's blocked so many people on Twitter, but then again, they won't say anything about San Diego. So how does that look? You know, you block us on Twitter.
All right.
You don't mention us, you know?
All right. Quickly, who will you root for this season? Do you have a team? Can you sit out a football season? Or is it just, hey, nobody anymore?
Oh, man. I've been thinking about this for a long time. And when I watched the Chargers lose the Broncos, I felt no feeling. I felt nothing at all. When they scored the first touchdown, I was like, I don't even care. When they blocked the field goal, I didn't care. Usually I'd be biting my nails, walking up and down, screaming, being so nervous.
Yeah.
But I wasn't. So I will root for any team that plays against the Chargers.
Yeah, it's like you just saw your ex-girlfriend and you didn't care. That tells you something, you know, Joseph. All right, I appreciate your time. That's Joseph McRae. Check him out. Check out what he's doing with the Chargers. Thank him for coming on the show. Punch It Audio is next.
Big We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald-Faced Truth Headquarters.
Hey, we're all about truth, justice, and the American way here, okay? Which is why we've spanned the globe and pulled the top audio cuts of the day.
You're going to hear little snippets of sound.
Hey, it's time for Punch It Audio.
All right, we take a trip around the world of sports. It'll include ducks and beavers and everything in between. But we start in Cleveland, where the Cleveland Indians have now won 21 straight games. Punch it.
Ian Kinsler at the plate, 0 for 4 on the afternoon. Swings at the first pitch and a line drive to left field. Caught by Lonnie Chisenhall. It's over. 21 in a row. The Cleveland Indians have set a new record for the longest win streak in American League history.
There it is, Cleveland's 21st, 29,346, standing and stomping at the end of this game. Cody Allen got his 27th save. You heard it there. Indians, by the way, in this streak, have rarely been tied for nine innings. They've rarely even been in a tie. Their starters are 19-0 with a 1.70 ERA. They've outscored their opponents 139-35. And guess how many innings they've trailed in? In 189 innings, they've trailed in only four innings during that streak. Cleveland Indians now chasing the New York Giants' major league record of 26 straight. LeVar Ball talking. He says the Lakers are going to ball from day one. Here's LeVar. Punch it.
No, this ain't no warm-up year. We're going to ball straight from day one. It's good if you
got everyone in LA like
that. What do you mean by ball, though? Like, I'm talking, you're going to be like, you're going to be a real contender.
Everyone in LA is having a party.
You guys can't even stand how good he's going to be. This is easy for him. This is 100% in. He don't have to go to school. He get to practice all day. I'm going to tell you, it's going to be an easy, fun season for him. He get to play with the best athletes he's ever played.
What's your definition of easy? Well, you talk about this season being successful. I'm just saying, I understand that you believe in your son. Your son can ball. His vision is just an intelligent basketball player. He looks like he's going to be special. Fair enough. What the Lakers going to do this year, man?
50-plus wins.
You must be. What? What did you just, say?
He can fit 50 out of 80 games.
I'm going to get somebody drug test you.
Playoff time. You must be crazy. But you know what?
You must be crazy.
LeVar Ball predicting 50 wins for the Lakers. Vegas says 36.5. You like the over? LeVar does. Let's go to the Pac-12. Mike Leach talking about women coaching. Here's Washington State's coach. Punch it.
You know, I don't think that all of a sudden there's going to be more women's coaches than men's coaches. There's more men coaching female sports than females, per se. But I think that, you know, no matter what sport you are, you're looking for quality coaches. And if somebody's a quality coach and truly dedicated, and then that's, you know, their passion, the sport they study, and that type of thing, then, you know, I think it's like any skill. You learn and you study it and you develop your skills at it.
Here's the bottom line. As long as the person, male or female, knows what they're talking about, knows what they're doing, I don't think guys that are playing football are going to care if it's man, woman, tall, short. Think about it. Leach is a guy who did not play football. He's a lawyer. Dennis Franchione never played. Charlie Weiss didn't play. Lou Holtz didn't play. They knew. Yeah, the hardest thing about it is that women don't grow up generally playing the sport. But in my opinion, to me, it's not about gender here. It's about, hey, do you know what you're talking about? And I think we will see a woman coaching a team, a major college football team. They say 2027. They say 10 years from now. Could that happen? I would vote yes. Put me among the yeses in the next 10 years. Ryan Nall, Oregon State running back, looking in the rearview mirror at the Minnesota game. How'd you play? Punch it.
You know, we didn't necessarily execute as a team. I think that's the best way to sum it up. We turned the ball over on offense, which led to touchdowns for them, and and that's just defeating to see as a group. You know, as far as my personal play, you know, I try to give my all at all times, and even though I'm not necessarily in the entire time, I'll be on the sideline and be the best cheerleader there is.
We need more of Ryan Nall. Oregon State needs more of Ryan Nall for them to be successful. When things are going right, this is Ryan Nall's team. The problem has been that Oregon State's identity has been a muddled mess on offense, and their identity on defense is soft. It's not good. It's not a good combination. We don't know who they are. Are they trying to throw the ball? Are they a smash-mouth team? We don't know who they are, and we're already now looking at, hey, you're going to play your fourth game of the year. That's a problem. You're, a quarter of the way through your season after this week? And we still don't know your identity. That's bad. Willie Taggart, Oregon Ducks coach. They have a WWE championship belt that they give out for their special teams player of the week. Why do they do that? Coach Taggart, punch it.
It's a belt that our guys have. Coach Woody got in special team, and the special team player of the week get to wear the belt. You know, it's something those guys take pride in. We call it a special team the pack, and they take pride in being in the pack, and the guy that gets the player of the week get to walk around with a championship belt is pretty neat. It's a pretty heavy belt, too, so... pretty cool.
By the way, outfielder Josh Reddick with the Astros, he did it too. He bought a belt when he was at the Red Sox, the A's, the Dodgers. He got custom belts made, and he gave it away to the player of the game in the locker room. Alabama has a wrestling title belt on the sideline. You know this radio show has a title belt? Yeah. We used to, back in the day, have a title belt that we would give out. I think Stephanie Strickland, television anchors, got the belt at her house. She called me one day and she's like, I got this wrestling belt of yours. Do you want it back? And I was like, yes, drop it off, please. But I noticed during the Alabama-Clemson game, the national title game, that there was a belt on the sideline that was making rounds. I like the idea of a belt. You should have a championship belt in your household. Like, I grew up, we had a plate, a dinner plate, that was a bright red plate when I was a kid. And it went to whoever in the household had done something remarkable that day or had something special. Like, if it's your birthday, you get the plate. You get the special plate. If you gotten good grades, you got a special plate. If, like, my brother had he went to class, he got a good report from his teacher, he got the special plate. It was a reward in our household. We passed it around. I would have much rather had a WWE belt to wear. Like, paraded around the household, run down the hallway with it. I have carried that tradition forward at our house today. We have a plate that we pass around. I'm not sure the kids get it. Some of them are too young. But, you know, mainly it turns into somebody being honored for whatever. You should have something like that in your household. We should have something like that at this show. Generally, in an office like this, a fork would be reward enough. Because, like, there's a shortage of forks if you go to eat something. I saw Alabama Adriana, not lying, eating like she was a character on Game of Thrones, eating a salad with her hands. It was enough to go, you know, if we had a fork. Brandon, I think we need a special fork. Hey, you've had a good day. You get the fork today.
Just carry that around solely.
That's it. A bell, a fork, something like that. Willie Taggart also talking about the night before a road kickoff. They're at Wyoming on Saturday. What will they do the night before the game? Punch it.
The night before, they watch a movie together, and then they go to bed. You know, we'll eat dinner, they watch a movie, and then they go to bed. And game day, we'll meet, walk through, and get ready for the game.
Now, what movie is that going to be? Can we have suggestions for the movie? If you are a Duck fan, tweet at me. At John Canzano BFT, give me your suggestions for the movie. What should Oregon be watching the night before the game? I like Braveheart. I always do, and I always play this cut, but I like Braveheart as a movie, like night before game, Shawshank Redemption, night before game. Got to have a little motivation. Got to fire me up. A little Rudy, maybe I'm too old. But that's kind of where I would go. I'd go with, like, the Braveheart theme, Mel Gibson.
Fight and you may die. Run, and you'll live. At least a while. And dying in your beds, many years from now,
Would you be willing to trade all the days from this day to that for one chance, just one chance, to come back here and tell our enemies that they may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom?
Imagine, like, Royce Freeman running through the hallways of the team hotel after hearing that, seeing that. Coach Carter would be a good one. Remember the Titans would be a good one. What else you got for the for Willie Taggart? Let's help him out. You can tweet at me at John Canzano BFT with your motivational movies. Moving on, we had a guest on the show earlier today, just a few minutes ago, Joseph McRae. Joseph McRae is interesting. He's a fan. He's a former Chargers fan who's angry about the Chargers leaving San Diego. Punch it.
Oh, man. I've been thinking about this for a long time. And when I watched the Chargers lose the Broncos, I felt no feeling. I felt nothing at all. When they scored their first touchdown, I was like, I don't even care. When they blocked the field goal, I didn't care. Usually I'd be biting my nails, walking up and down, screaming, being so nervous that I wasn't. So I will root for any team that plays against the Chargers.
All right, so now he's saying that he feels apathy when it comes to his team. He's angry. He's gone to the news conference and flipped off the owner of the Chargers. He's bought billboards, raised $10,000 to buy billboards. Help me out with this. Is this a fan who's gone too far and crossed the line? Or is this a guy who does epitomize the modern sports fan? 503-417-7575. Your turn. This morning, something happened, and sometimes the news is the news, right? Sometimes something happens, and you go, all right, that's newsy. That's interesting to me. Generally, you'll see it on Twitter or Facebook or on Oregon Live or LATimes.com or wherever you're getting your news. Facebook, if you are a woman 25 plus, you're probably on Facebook. So here's the deal. Something happened. Some news was announced. It's big news. But it got announced at 10:30 this morning, and I'm in the sports media business, and I really didn't become aware of it until just a few minutes ago. And this is not because I had my head buried in the sand, but because I think people don't care that much. See, Los Angeles has been trying to get the Olympic Games for a long time. And this was really interesting because the International Olympic Committee voted with giving the 2024 games to Paris and giving the 2028 games to Los Angeles in the same vote. And I think it got buried a little bit. Like, the news got buried because 2028 is a long way off. And so the Olympic Games of 2028 are coming to LA. The Coliseum, the Staples Center, everything's, they've been awarded the bid. And this happened because there are scandals involving the Rio bid in 2016 and the Tokyo bid in 2020. The Ethics Commission of the IOC is looking into it. Now, LA and Paris had their hands clean here. And so I think what happened is the IOC said, hey, we don't want any more trouble. These are two bids that these cities want the bid. Let's just vote. Let's knock it out right now because we got problems with Rio and Tokyo and people may go to prison for this. So they did it. The United States Olympic Committee, the IOC, Paris got 2024. The L.A. bid of 2028 got accepted and voted in today. I always talk about the Olympics as being like a bucket list thing. It's not coming any closer to you unless it comes to Portland. So if you have a chance to go to the Olympics in 2028, I would put it on the calendar, put it on your radar, put it on top of mind. I've got to see a lot of things in my career as a journalist. I think one of the most interesting, best parts of the job that I have is that I have been in different venues, different stadiums. You know, I've been in a lot of NFL stadiums, Major League Baseball stadiums. I've covered 9 Super Bowls, multiple World Series, multiple Final Fours, maybe 10 Final Fours. I've been to 5 or 6 or 8 BCS title games. seen a lot of different things. Kentucky Derby, the Belmont Stakes, five Olympics games. I've been to five Olympics games. So I went to the Olympics in Sydney. I went to the Olympics in Athens. I went to the Olympics in Beijing. I went to the Olympics in London. I went to the Winter Games in Vancouver. And let me tell you, the Winter Games in Vancouver sucked compared to the other ones. Sydney was amazing because it was my first Olympics. I'd never been to Australia, and it was my first taste of what an Olympics was about. And what you gather when you go to cover an Olympics or you go to watch an Olympics is it is a massive sporting event that is held over a 17 or 20-day period in the middle of summer. It's exhausting and simultaneously emotionally thrilling. And I will remember, like, the first time I was a young journalist, I didn't know what I was doing. I'm covering the Olympics in Australia, in Sydney. And you travel what seems like forever to get to Sydney. You get there, and now the opening ceremonies come on, and you're running around trying to cover this thing. And you're realizing what I realized in Australia, my big light bulb moment in being there for an Olympics, was that we'd been lied to for years as Americans. We'd been lied to, we had been manipulated, and we had been steered by the coverage that NBC and others that were covering these games gave to us. Because what I found in Australia was there were amazing moments, there were emotional moments that had to do with countries that were not the United States of America that people at home were not even seeing. When Kathy Freeman ran for Australia in the women's 400 and won it, I had never seen anything like that in that stadium where she ran and won the 400 meters. And she was an Aboriginal woman who, you know, in that country, the Aboriginal people discriminated against, pushed to the back. You go into a restaurant, the Aboriginal people are working in the back of the restaurant, not the front. And so it was a big deal for Kathy Freeman to run carrying the Aboriginal flag around the stadium while also carrying the flag of her country. It was this unifying moment. It was very emotional. People were crying. She was crying. And I remember her running around the stadium, and I just had chills thinking, wow, this is like the most amazing thing. And then I call home, and I'm like, Mom, did you watch Kathy Freeman run? And she was like, oh, NBC didn't show it because NBC was showing Americans. So that's what I learned that first Olympics game. And also, by the way, it's so massive, you can't do it all. It's bigger than Disneyland. Like, you go to Disneyland, there's this feeling where, what do you do when you walk into Disneyland with your kids, Cliss? You walk in through the gates, and you take inventory. Like, all right, what rides are, like, how early do you start plotting your what you're going to do?
Well, before I get there. We usually pick, like, one land we're going to go to first and then, you know, kind of say we need to hit all these attractions and go from there.
Do you have a strategy if you have a trip where you're going to be there multiple days?
Yeah. Go early. I usually go to the left because it seems like everybody goes to Fantasyland or Tomorrowland first. And then take a break in the middle of the day, take a nap, go to the pool, and then go back out, you know, eat dinner and go late.
Definite strategy at Disneyland. Well, there's a strategy at the Olympics, too. And the strategy is this. You can't do it all in one day. You can't do it all in one trip to the Olympics. You can't see everything. And so there's a real temptation, if you're there, to be like, I need to go to the pool. I need to go to men's basketball. I need to go to gymnastics. Oh, my gosh, they're swimming. Oh, I missed this synchronized swimming. Oh, track and field starting. I need to go here. So you try to run all over the country, and you can kill yourself, literally, like, kill yourself. I remember in Athens, which was my second Olympics, same thing. I lost 11 pounds while covering the Olympics. It's the greatest diet ever because I was running everywhere. That second Olympics in Athens was something else, too, because they weren't ready. And that's the other thing you learn. Like, we're used to the American sports experience, like the Super Bowl, our big events. And the cool thing about an Olympics is the international feel to it. And I think the LA Games will be a little less international, but I think you're going to get a lot of foreign visitors that want to come to LA from China and Japan and Amsterdam and, you know, everywhere else. And they want to go see what the United States is about in this Olympics festival. So if you get a chance in 2028 to go to LA, if you get a chance to go to Japan between now and then, or Paris in 2024, I think I'll do maybe one more Olympics that I would really want to go to. But I've covered all those other things. There's nothing like the Olympics because you're watching the culminating moment of somebody's life. You're watching this emotional moment where, like, it could be a wrestler from Kazakhstan or whatever country, and you're watching this guy and you realize he gave up his, you know, he is only on the Olympic team because his older brother gave up his spot. And now he's wrestling for a gold medal. I remember going to watch an American wrestler named Stephen Abbas wrestle a Russian guy for a gold medal. And of course, I'm an American. So I go there going, all right, this would be a great story if Stephen Abbas wins this thing. Well, the Russian guy beat him. And I go to the post-game news conference, the post-match news conference, and Abbas and this other wrestler are in there. And they've already wrestled. They've been in, like, the most intimate of positions in wrestling each other on a mat, right? I mean, they must be familiar with each other in every way possible. And yet, it became evident they knew nothing about each other as people. I was shocked by this. So in the news conference, like, people are asking the Russian guy about how he got on the team, and his brother and he wrestled the same weight. And they both got to the Olympic trials. And the brother refused to wrestle him in the Olympic trials in Russia. And he was talking about how his father said, hey, only one of you can wrestle here. And this is not going to be decided on the mat. They decided it in their family who would wrestle at that weight class. I mean, and Abbas, like, looked over like, that is the cool. And Abbas has a bunch of brothers. He looked over and was like, that is the coolest thing ever. His brother just said, no, I want you to go to the Olympics because you're the older brother. So, yes, go see the Olympics. Leave it here. All right, if you're a Duck fan, we have a little contest going on for you. Chance to win a 4-pack of tickets to the Ducks Arizona State viewing party at the Skype Live studio Saturday, September 23rd. Here's how you enter to win those. You can text UO to 64636 for your chance to win a 4-pack of tickets to the Ducks Arizona State viewing party. So text UO to 64636 to have an opportunity to do that. We've already covered the Cleveland Indians. Congratulations to them. I guess it's good to be a Cleveland Indians fan. If you're a Duck fan or a Beaver fan, it got me thinking about something, though. Because, like, there haven't been a lot of great moments in Cleveland Indians baseball history. But if you're an Indians fan, you're coming off a year in which, you know, it was a really good year for the Indians. Came really close last year. Now they're a 90-win team. And they're already a 90-win team. And here's an opportunity here with 21 straight wins. If you're an Indians fan, this might be the heyday of Cleveland Indians baseball. Maybe apologies to Rocky Colavito, okay? This might be the heyday. Joe Charbonneau could have been, would have been, but wasn't. So if you're an Indians fan, you're having the time of your life as an Indians fan. And it got me thinking, for Beaver fan, Duck fan, Blazer fan, and only you can answer this, because I think the answer may be different for some of you. I want you to tell me, when was the heyday for your team that you rooted for? Who was that team? And what was the heyday? Were you an Oklahoma fan when they won 54 in a row in the 1950s and on? Were you a Blazer fan in 1977? Was that the heyday, or was it the early 90s team, the Blazers team that won 16 in a row? If you're a Duck fan, what was the heyday of Oregon Ducks football, basketball? If you're a Beaver fan, what's the heyday? Tell me when the time of your life as a sports fan was and who was the team. 503-417-7575 is the number. Weigh in on that. I can only speak for myself growing up as a San Francisco 49ers fan that the heyday for me of being a San Francisco 49ers fan didn't really come with the Steve Young Niners that were so dominant. They were good. I mean, they were dominant and good. But I'll be honest, like, it meant more to me the Golden Joe Montana, Ronnie Lott 49ers of, like, the 1981 Super Bowl in Pontiac, Michigan, Super Bowl 16. That 49ers team and maybe some subsequent teams after that were, to me, the heyday of being a 49er fan. I might argue that being a Giants fan was in its heyday when Barry Bonds was hitting home runs at a record pace. But if an older Giants fan calls into the show and you know, has a longer memory than I do, they're going to have a different experience. And that's what I'm looking at here is I want you to tell me your fan base, who you root for, and what the heyday was of that fan base. I want to hear from you whether it was a, you know, Ducks fan, Beavers fan, whatever the case may be. Was it as a Giants fan when Pablo Sandoval was in uniform?
The 1-1 pitch. He swings and he bounces on. Deep center field. Jackson is going back. And goal! A home run! Number 3 for Pablo Sandoval. His first 3 at bats in this World Series. And Pablo Sandoval looks like the Babe himself has come back to life.
He looks like the Babe himself, said John Miller. What, if you're a Ducks fan, what's the heyday? What's the heyday of Oregon football, Oregon basketball? You tell me. How about Marcus Mariota winning the Heisman?
Thank you. I'm humbled to be standing here today and honored by this award. Thank you, Heisman Trust, for making this night possible. Everything you do has made so many dreams come true.
Is that the heyday of Oregon football? 503-417-7575. Give me your fan base. Like, who do you align yourselves with? And what's the heyday? Because I think there are some of you out there that would look back to the Oregon State football run that Dennis Erickson brought into the program and the Fiesta Bowl. And you would say, that is the heyday. That was magic. Oregon State went 11-1. You know, this was historic. And it was, you know, the return of pride to the Oregon State fan base. It, you know, here they go. And this was an opportunity. 33-year losing streak to USC. Won a share of the Pac-10 championship. It was the first time Oregon State won a share of the championship since the expansion of the conference in 1978. To me, that was the heyday. But you lived it. You were in it. Tell me. Let's go to the phones. Tom's in Portland. Tom, who'd you root for? When was the heyday?
Well, I go back a few more years than you, John, but growing up in Corvallis, Oregon, Slats Gill was the coach of the OSU Beavers, and they were consistently one of the top teams in the nation. And in 1955, they played the winner against the San Francisco Dons, Bill Russell, Art Farmer, Casey Jones, against Oregon State, and it went down to the final seconds, and the Dons pulled it out by 1 point, and they went on to win the national championship. And that was a real highlight.
It's always bothered me that Slatskill ended at 599 wins. I every time I see that, I want him to have 600. I don't know if that bothers Tom. But, yeah, you're talking about a guy who in 1962-63 went to the Final Four. 1948-1949 went to the Final Four. Is that the heyday for Oregon State? Let's go to Mark in Portland. Mark, what do you got?
Yeah, I'm a Houston sports fan. And for all of Houston sports, it has to have been when the Rockets made their run in 94, 95, 96 under Hakeem Olajuwon.
Hakeem should have been a Blazer. You know that, right?
There was a lot of shoulda, woulda, couldas, but
yeah.
Starting with being down 2-0 in a best-of-5 series against Phoenix, and coming back 3 games in a row in the first round of the playoffs and pulling off the first Houston championship in any sport, basketball, football, baseball, and then next year bringing on Clyde, bringing him back to Houston,
yeah,
was a great thing.
There's a mural at the arena there in Houston that you would love, Mark. It depicts Robert Horry and Olajuwon and Drexler, Mario Elie, and it's like – it is reflective of that period of the 1990s. The Rockets were his team, and that was the heyday. One line open, 503-417-7575. Chris in Portland. Go ahead, Chris.
Well, I'm a Packer fan, okay. And I was born in 66. So, you know, as a young kid, you know, I hear all these great stories, and unfortunately, they just sucked for so long. And, you know, you're getting in fights on the playground every day from Cowboy fans and Steeler fans. And finally, in 92, when Brett Barbara came on board, you know, it was so nice to have that run from 92 to, I think it was 96 when they won the Super Bowl. You know, those were one of those things that, you know, for your whole life, basically, they were just horrible. And all of a sudden, they came to you know, a high stature. And it was such a great feeling to be part of that, so to speak.
Then they got really good. And then everybody hated Brett Favre again because they got too good. It's true, though. I saw a statistic the other day on those Packers teams. So Brett Favre came on the scene in 92 and left in 2007. He threw for 61,000 yards in that time. That's a heyday. Gary's in Vancouver. Gary, what do you got?
I was a Dodger fan in the Bay Area, constantly tortured by the Giants back in Willie Mays, Willie McCovey, Cepeda, Marichal, and all them guys. I actually lived next door to the coach of the Santa Clara Broncos and got a chance to go be bat boy at a Bronco-San Francisco Giants game. They offered me to be a bat boy in the Giant dugout, and I said, you wouldn't catch me dead in there.
I got one for you, though. How about this? You know, when Dusty Baker was the Giants manager, I was covering the Giants, and here was a Dodger who became the Giants manager. And Dusty in his office had that photo of Juan Marichal holding the bat and going after John Roseborough of the Dodgers with the bat. I mean, that was like so reflective of that rivalry. Skippy's in Forest Grove. Skippy, what do you got?
Well, you know, I was 16 years old when I was sitting in Candlestick Park with my uncle when the earthquake hit. And at that moment before the earthquake hit, I was in the heyday of my absolute sports nirvana with the Giants in the World Series.
October 17th, 1989.
I was sitting there with my uncle in Candlestick Park. I was a 16-year-old kid. I was scared out of my mind, and it took us 9 hours to get back to his house.
Bro.
And he had me flown home like a day or two later. But I'll never forget that. But, of course, in recent years, my Giants have gone on to capture 3 World Series. And, you know.
That series never should have been played. That's what I keep saying as a Giants fan. The Giants were worried about, like, hey, this was a disaster, and lives were in danger and lost, and the A's were focused on baseball. And the Giants were focused on people. That's what always comes back with me, that Bay Bridge series. Yeah, that's a series I'd like to see replayed with the old guys. Leave it here.
I want you all to listen up. This is important stuff, all right?
Okay. Here we go.
The bald-faced truth.
Call 503-417-7575 or 877-733-0750 or text to 64636.
Here we go in 3, 2.
Now, from the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
This portion of the Bald-Faced Truth is brought to you by High Caliber Millwrights. Need a machinery job done right? Call High Caliber today.
Gary Anderson, Oregon State football coach, joining us. We were just talking about which teams people root for and what was the best time to be a fan of that team. Growing up, did you have a team you rooted for or a team you were a fan of?
The Miami Dolphins was my team, and my mom was a Redskins fan. So it was back and forth the days when those guys were battling. Still love the Dolphins to this day.
Why did you pick the Dolphins?
I have no idea. I've thought about that many times. So just it was the Larry Zonka, Jim Kick, all those guys of that time frame, and I had it all. I had the comforter, the posters, the dresser painted, all that stuff. It was a pretty cool room I had, but I love the Dolphins.
You had some good times. I mean, you had Greasy at quarterback, Zonka in that backfield. Those were not bad teams.
Those were really good teams, yeah. Fun to be a fan for the Dolphins at that point, that's for sure. I was just a young kid, but it was good times. We had some real rivalry between me and Ma.
But you weren't like living in Miami, or they weren't like there was no brush you had in an airport with Zonka or something like that that turned you to Miami.
Zero connection. I don't know why. I have no idea why.
This football team ready to play?
Absolutely. Yeah, we had a good practice today. Going in and starting to watch the film for practice, and we'll come back here this afternoon, lift some weights, and get back onto a third practice tomorrow morning. So they're excited for another opportunity.
The locker room, when you have a half like you had in the second half against Minnesota, you come in, what can you say after a game? What can you say in the subsequent days to pull the team back together?
Well, you know, I personally, I've always been a believer in that you try to prepare for the good times and the bad times. And this team is, you know, they've had some tough times come their way, and a couple tough ball games where we have not played well as a football team. And so there's not a bunch to say in those settings. I'm not a guy that's going to sit in there and yell and scream and whine and cry and all that stuff that comes with it. I'm going to talk to them briefly about the expectations of where we're going, how to represent their team. And, you know, we've got to come back and we have to be able to move on in those scenarios. And in my opinion, that's the best ways to approach it. And, you know, we come back on Monday, and then we learn on Monday from the good and the bad, win or lose. But I'm not a guy that sits there and talks to them for, you know, 15 or 20 minutes after a game, win or loss. That's emotional times on both sides, and I think you have to be real productive. You're always asking for a professional environment on the sidelines, and I think you as a coach, if you ask for that, then you need to make sure that you have a professional side to you when you're in adversity and when you're also in good times.
That's interesting, because there's part of me that would want to come in after you feel like, hey, we didn't play our half. In this game, you're in this game at halftime. You come into the second half, and you're obviously disappointed when you leave the field. There was part of me that would want to go in there, and I would want to kick butt. Like, I would want to be like, you know, we didn't perform. I'm embarrassed. You should be embarrassed. But you've got to hold back a little bit.
I think there's a time and a place for those to be a little bit more aggressive, depending on the time and the situation. But to, you know, again, make just complete emotional decisions in that setting. I've really tried to pride myself with this group of kids as we try to continue to grow. There is professionalism to big time college athletics at any level, and you have to be able to have that. It helps in your communication between series. It helps in your communication at halftime. It helps your communication during the week, and all those things that matter. And I learned that long, long ago from Ed Whittingham when I was a young coach, that how important that was for you to be able to develop that as you move through your time. So again, there's different approaches, but my approach at that point is to, yes, be stern. Yes, let them know that we didn't accomplish the goal if we've lost the football game. But to go on a tangent and rant and rave at that point, I don't believe that's the time. A challenge is much different than a rant.
Gary Anderson, Oregon State coach. People want to know why Ryan Nall's not getting the ball more. What's the answer to that?
Well, they'll run the ball. I don't care who's running the ball at this point. We have not been effectively running the football and moving the line of scrimmage to give him the opportunity. So we need to be able to give Ryan an opportunity to gain the yards that he needs. And, you know, getting ganged up on the line of scrimmage is getting ganged up on the line of scrimmage. And so we talk and it's blah, blah, blah about, hey, now we've got to throw the ball better. We've got to do this. We've got to do that. Bottom line, it was a debacle last week. And, again, not pointing fingers, I look at myself. I was horrible as far as giving Ryan, AP, anybody an opportunity, because I'm in charge of those coaches again. So we need to adjust the scheme. We need to come up with some ideas. We need to have some plans to be able to get those kids the ball where there's a crease and they can use their ability to be able to do some things for us. Because what we've done is not good enough for Ryan Nall to be able to use his skill set or AP or Trey or any of them to be effective runners. And that's just the truth. That's the bald-faced truth, if you will. Ha-ha.
I love it.
Gary Anderson with us. Is it as simple as defenses are going, look, we're not going to let you run the ball, and until you hurt them with the pass game, they'll stay that way?
That's a part of it. And then your ability to be able to say, hey, we can hang in there with you and be physical and be very, very gap sound. And are your schemes in that, you know, your schemes are one of two things. Either you're going to say, hey, physically, okay, go ahead and gang up on the box. We're still going to get the movement we need to get you moved out of the way, and then we're going to get to the next level one-on-one at your free hitter and give our guy a chance to have some space. Or you have to be able to find a way to create those gaps and through pulling schemes or power screens or down schemes or whatever that may be to conflict those free hitters so they may not be in the proper spot. And the direction that we had was we'll come in and knock you off the ball, and we failed at that. So we need to take a look and see what is next. What is the next step in the run game to be able to put us in a position to be able to be successful? Because, yes, they're bringing free hitters down just like everybody does against 11 personnel teams, and they've been very effective against us.
All right, so you watch film, you watch the game, you're emotional about the game. How do you get your sanity and keep your sanity amid that? Are you watching any TV? Are you working out? Are you movies? What do you do?
Not much right now. My sanity is truly and honestly is to break down as much as I can on Washington State and, you know, try to help the defense turn around and get better and use my knowledge base, which is on that side of the ball, try to help the defense right now. And that's been my function, and that's where I'll be. And, you know, I can't go into an offensive room and give them some ideas, but I can't create an offense. That's not my area of training. So I'll help the defense, but that's to keep my sanity right now is probably impossible. And the kids bring me back. I'm excited to work with my kids every single day and try to help them get better. And they're the ones that bring back a smile on my face and bring back an opportunity for us to be able to compete again. But I wouldn't use I'm real sane right now is a good place to be. It's not. I'm not. Just not. I can't lie to you. So I'll keep banging and working at this thing to get it the right way, and we all need to take responsibility and continue to move forward because we have to do the kids right in the program and work to do that, and we have to do the Beaver Nation right, and we have to work to get that done, and we're not doing it.
Mike Leach came on yesterday on the show, and he pretty much said, hey, they've got the same amount of talent that we got. He said that last year, and everybody kind of looks over and goes, yeah, you have all seniors on the offensive line. You've got Luke Falk at quarterback. You've got receivers. When you look at their personnel on the offensive side of the ball, what do you see?
Well, I think Mike's done a great job of recruiting to his scheme. And I think the unsung heroes that I see as a huge part of their offense is the running backs. They're powerful. They're strong. They're patient. They aren't counting their reps as far as how many carries they get. They make their reps count, and those kids don't worry if they have 2 reps or if they get 20 reps with the ball in their hand, and they're going to play like crazy. See, I almost swore right there, but I didn't, so that was good. I look at Luke is Luke. He's a tremendous quarterback, and they have an offensive line that does their job within their job description extremely well, and they have a whole bunch of reps underneath their belt. You know, they got a new center this year and another guard that is a little bit new, but they got a bunch of seniors in there that played a ton of reps. So offensively, it's a very well-rounded football team, and if you just, you know, again, you got to decide what you want to do. Washington last year comes in and plays very conventional defense against them and plays extremely well with very, very gifted and talented players. And then on the flip side of that, you have to look and say, okay, now where do you fit into that equation? You have to be able to look and say, okay, if it's just quarters coverage and you're not getting a great pass rush with your guys, you got to create that pass rush in different ways. Minnesota, I thought last year in their Holiday Bowl, did a tremendous job of keeping them off balance and getting Luke off his spot and allowing the defense to be able to cause some confusion through some coverage matchups. So there's a challenge in definitely lining up against this offense. It's a talented group of kids, and you have to put in enough defense to be able to allow your kids to play fast, but yet hopefully cause some confusion.
Yeah, you've got people like me saying, hey, they should do this, and fans saying, hey, they should do that. How much of that do you pay attention to, or do you just kind of smile politely and go, yeah, we're working on it?
Trust me, I understand the complete frustrations, and I would say this. There is nobody more frustrated than I am. So if people are as frustrated as I am, I get it. I understand it. It's important for me to do my best to try to not make them be frustrated. And I'll do my best to keep banging there and keep on fighting to get these kids where they need to be. But I'll always have my kids back, and I'll work hard to get them where they need to be. And like I always tell my kids, I'll keep banging for you every day. But there is that frustration level. People have the right to be able to voice their opinions. I understand all that. I don't tend to listen to that. I don't want to be able to be. I don't want the negative. I don't want the positive. When things are really good, I didn't read the newspaper when we've had some really good times here at Oregon State. I look at Twitter because I don't have Twitter. I don't read news articles. It's just not me. I'm just going to keep on grinding, and my job is to take care of the kids in this program and work hard to be able to take care of them on and off the field and then represent Beaver Nation the right way on and off the field. And we are not doing a good job when it comes to the football games. I understand that.
We had Leach on yesterday. He was eating grits during the interview. What did you have for lunch today?
Two little pieces of chicken, and what else did I have? Probably about 6 or 7 pieces of broccoli. That's a wrap.
Yeah, that's good. That's healthy.
Yeah, it is healthy. It's the vitamins. I always take my vitamins.
Are you cooking for yourself, or somebody packing that for you, or how's that happen?
No, our kids are well fed. They're well taken care of, so we got to go eat lunch with the players. Man. So, which is another good time. Get to sit in there with the boys.
I'm eating out of a vending machine over here. I need to cook.
Let me know what you need. I'll order it for you.
Gary Anderson, good luck to you against Washington State. We'll talk to you next week.
I appreciate it always. Go Beavs.
All right. There he is, Gary Anderson, the Oregon State coach. Yeah, it's true. I mean, out of a vending machine, that guy's having chicken and broccoli. No wonder he's in phenomenal shape. Tell me what you heard there from Gary Anderson. Do you have faith that he's going to turn it around? That's a simple question. Give me the simple answer. 503-417-7575. BetterCrawlSpaces.com, that's the website you need to know about. That's John's Waterproofing's website. Go to BetterCrawlSpaces.com if you have a basement or crawl space that needs some attention. And by attention, I mean, do you have standing water? Do you have a crack in the foundation? Is there a funny, musty smell coming from the basement or the crawl space? Mildew? Mold? John's Waterproofing can help you cut off any kind of permanent damage and help you protect your investment. In the case of moisture, you don't want moisture in the crawl space. John's Waterproofing can help you with that and anything to do with your basement or crawl space. Go to BetterCrawlSpaces.com, BetterCrawlSpaces.com to find out more. And tell them you're a BFT listener. I use them. I'm a customer of John's Waterproofing. We've used them in a rental house that we have in Oregon City. We've encapsulated the crawl space. It has made all the difference with that house. And I would encourage you, if you've got an issue, to give John's Waterproofing a chance to give you a free estimate and help you out as well. BetterCrawlSpaces.com. Whether you're listening in Eugene, Salem, Portland, Vancouver, wherever you may be, BetterCrawlSpaces.com. All right, Gary Anderson I thought was good. I mean, I like Gary Anderson. I like Willie Taggart. I like Mike Leach. It's hard to find people I don't like anymore. I like everybody. I don't know what's going on here. But Gary Anderson joins us on the show and says that nobody's more frustrated than he is. He's going to keep banging his head against the wall, and he's going to keep fighting, and he's going to always have his, you know, kids' backs. But do you believe that Gary Anderson could turn it? Do you not believe that Gary Anderson could turn this thing? And tell me why. Maybe it doesn't have to do with Gary Anderson. Maybe you just don't think Oregon State can win. Tell me what you think at 503-417-7575. Want to hear from you. We've talked about being a fan on today's show. I grew up a fan. We had a fan on the show who is taking out a billboard near the StubHub Center in Los Angeles because he's mad that the Chargers left San Diego. We had him on the show. We talked to Robert Gagliardi of Wyoming Sports about fans in Wyoming and why fans in Laramie are so excited about Oregon coming to town. There's something about being a fan, man, that gets people so jazzed because it's emotional. People always say, well, there's fanatic in the word. The word is fanatic. And I'm like, of course it is. You are a fan. We're talking about being a fan. If you're a fan of Oregon State and Gary Anderson comes on a radio show and sounds like he just sounded and says, there's nobody more frustrated than I am. And here's the problem. And here's why Ryan Nall's not getting the ball. Do you buy that he can turn it around? Do you buy that he's the guy as a fan? You know, Mark Helfrich back in the day when he was getting destroyed.
Speaking of support, I thought our fans were phenomenal tonight, even late into the game when the outcome seemed imminent. I thought I thought our fans were outstanding. I apologize for that score.
See, what Helfrich was doing after giving up 70 to Washington was he was working the room there. I don't know if you caught that. After losing to Washington and giving up 70 points, he apologized to fans, and he said how phenomenal the fans were. You know what I heard in that news conference as I sat there that day after they gave up 70 to Washington? I heard a coach that was terrified that the mob was going to turn on him. I don't hear that from Anderson. I hear Anderson going, look, I get that you're mad. I'm frustrated too. I'll do my best. That's what I hear from Gary Anderson. So do you believe him? Do you believe that he can turn this thing? You tell me. You're the fan. You are the stakeholder. Let's go out to Ken, who's in Eugene. The phone number is 503-417-7575. Ken, go ahead. What do you think?
Hey, no, I don't think he can turn it around in Corvallis. I don't think that anyone really could on a regular basis. So every now and then a guy, like they can recruit somebody like the Rutgers brothers because they were willing to take them both, and they can catch lightning in a bottle every 10 or 15 years and have a decent season. But as long as it's Corvallis and the recruiting is the way it is, I don't think anyone's going to be able to turn it around.
Is there anything they could do to change that if you were Oregon State?
You know, I don't know. I thought Mike Riley might have been the guy that could attract people there, and he did a good job of that. You know, I'm originally from Alabama, and we see the same thing there with Alabama and Auburn. You know, it's Alabama gets the – they've always gotten the pick, you know, and every now and then Auburn, there's enough good players in the Southeast that they can do the kind of the same thing, but they can never really be like Alabama on a consistent level. And I don't think the Beavers will ever be able to do that, kind of like the Ducks, you know, went on their run. But the Ducks still have to go down and rob L.A. and places like that. So I just think here in this valley, it's so hard to get guys that want to come here and live here, you know.
Well, I think, you know, the same could be said of Eugene, right? I mean, couldn't it? So what has Oregon created? They've created coolness. There's a cool quotient at Oregon that kids want to play there. They've got resources, they've got facilities, they've got donors, a bigger base of donors, and season ticket holders, and that success begets success begets success. I look at Oregon State's history, and in the caller's defense, after DeAndros leaves, Craig Ferdig comes in, his best season's 3 wins, he's fired. Joe Avizzano comes in, his best season is 2 wins, he's fired. Dave Cragthorpe comes in, he wins 4 a couple years in a row. 4-6-1, 4-7-1, and 88-89, he's gone. Jerry Pettibone comes in. He won 4 a couple years. He also had some bad ones, 1-10 and 1-10. Before Mike Riley, it was, and you know that, it was bad. And Riley went in 5. Whoa, in 1998 was big because they hadn't won 5 games. You'd have to go all the way back to DeAndros in 1971. For a 5-win season. See, that's the fear I think Oregon State fans living with today. Let's go to Mike in Portland. Mike, what do you got?
Well, you know, first of all, I don't think they're going to ever change around. The difference between Oregon State and colleges that have...
Your phone's breaking up, Mike. I'm going to put you back on hold. You have to work that out. His phone's breaking up. It's too bad because I think he was saying Marcus Mariota won the day. He's winning the day. I caught that somewhere in the comments. Troy's in Salem. Troy, what do you got?
Well, you know, Oregon was just as bad as what Oregon State was as far as recruiting back in the day. I mean, you talked about him creating coolness and the money that was put into the facilities and able to attract the kids. And then, you know, until 1989, Oregon hadn't been to a bowl game since, what, 65 or something like that. And Rich Brooks kind of turned around and got him to the Rose Bowl, I believe, in 92, 93. But, you know, Oregon was just as bad. They used to be in the bottom 10 all the time. They used to have that in the newspapers, so they had a bottom 10, and it was just a top 20. And I remember every year back in the day just hoping that Oregon would never end up the bottom 10 because it seemed like the Kansas State at the time, Oregon State, TCU, and those teams were always like in the bottom 10. They were horrible, 2-9, 3-8.
Yeah. But see, when you look at Oregon's history, and I think you're right on, yeah, there was a total lack of bowl success. But even in Oregon's history, when you go back to Jerry Fry, it was 5 and 6 wins, okay? And even bad years like Dick Enright had a four-win season, and Rich Brooks came in and immediately, almost immediately, in year number three, won six games. Year number four won seven games. So the bar was raised to a point, but by the time 1989, when they make the Independence Bowl, that Oregon was at least operating from a little better foundation than Oregon State. Even though people do correlate, oh, it was lean at both places. Oregon's seasons in those eras were like four-win seasons, three-win seasons, five-win seasons. And Oregon State was winning one, two, four. So there was a different base there. The answer's obvious when it comes to Phil Knight. Like, Phil Knight has been a major difference maker for Oregon. Nike has been a major difference maker for Oregon. Oregon State has been chasing since that really blossomed. And I'll even go back to, like, conversations that Mike Bellotti had with me, and it was right around 1998, 99 that Bellotti talked about. Remember when Mike Bellotti had a chance to go? Prior to that, he had a chance to go to Ohio State to coach. And he calls Phil Knight, and he says, and Phil Knight had been ostracized from the university. Remember the sweatshops and all the stuff, and Oregon was distancing itself and saying, you know, and Mike Bellotti said to Phil Knight, I'm only going to be in if you're in. Like, there was, Mike Bellotti saw there was no point in him staying on as the Oregon coach if Phil Knight wasn't going to be there to back him. And Knight overnight came back the next morning. Bellotti tells me the story that Knight came back and said, I'm in. That was it. I'm in. That is a major difference maker. All right. Mike's in Portland. Mike, get your phone figured out.
So can you hear, is it better now?
Yeah. It's like you were on the Jameis Winston plan earlier. Now it's the Mariota plan.
No, man. But what I want to say, man, is it goes back to what you were talking about culture. That football team is out of place in that environment because it's a scientific school. Most football programs throughout the United States, the ones that do the have the best teams are liberal arts colleges. And so I think there's like this vacuum down there where the fan base, they're academic guys, this, what you call them, brainiac type people. They're down there for degrees and everything else, and you got this football team over here. For the most part, most of these guys probably just regular liberal arts guys. And so there's a disconnect. I think that's why the Ducks do better, because it's a liberal arts college. And the football players tend to be more liberal arts pursuing type individuals. So they can connect better with their fan base. So I don't think they'll ever be better. It's like the Ivy League colleges. They don't do good in football. There's just something about people that colleges that emphasize degrees and stuff like that, they just don't produce
all right.
good football.
So what I hear you say it is Oregon State needs to put education aside. Do you agree with Mike? Call in. Today, the White House press secretary called for the firing of ESPN's Jemele Hill. Good thing, good that this country has its eye on the ball. And how much smarter does W look and better as a president all these years later? All he needed was Donald Trump. President Trump to make him look smarter. I don't, whether you disagree or agree with Jemele Hill speaking out about the president, obviously ESPN disagreed with it. For the White House press secretary to use what is the people's podium to call for the firing of an individual citizen is kind of silly. Let's talk, though, about Oregon State. Oregon State, is there a way back for Oregon State? Can this program ever be a consistent winner? What needs to happen? What does Oregon State need to do? It's not as simple as giving Ryan Nall the ball. It has to be a cultural thing. It has to be the program. It has to be systemic for Oregon State to turn it around. David's in Eugene. The phone number is 503-417-7575. David's joining us now. David, what do you think?
Hey, John. I got to say, that last call was the most ridiculous call I've heard in a long time.
Whatever do you mean?
you know, last time I checked, I think Stanford, USC, UCLA, I think last time I checked, they had pretty high academic standards. So I think Michigan's a pretty good school, solid academic institution. So I don't know where that's coming from. It's a commitment from the administration just to get a coach in there that wants to win and knows how to recruit. I mean, go back to Denny Erickson. You know, I mean, the guy didn't apologize for who he was. He was a football coach. He wasn't so much worried about this and that. And did he skirt the issue and push the envelope? Absolutely. But that's what it's going to take. And I'm a Duck fan. I'm just saying that if they want to get back to that. And it's going to be hard to compete in the Valley on recruiting. I get that. But it's just a commitment from the university admin to win and get a coach in there. And I look, Anderson's a good guy, I think. Is he the guy to take him back to the glory days of when Danny was there? I don't think so.
Yeah, and look, here's the thing. Maybe this is a question for Dennis Erickson.
Get him on the show.
Maybe we get Dennis Erickson on the show and we go, hey, Dennis, how do you win 11? Dennis Erickson won 11 games. Yeah, he had guys on the goalposts afterwards celebrating a touchdown, frisking each other. You know, it was clear what Dennis Erickson did. He took fallen angels. He took guys that, hey, look, we're Oregon State. We're going to have to take some guys that other places won't take. Mike's call, it was absurd. It was, but I at least appreciated that he was reaching for a reasonable explanation. He didn't find one, but he was reaching. The bottom line is, like, you can't say it's a liberal arts thing. You can't say it's education. You look at the top 20 schools in win percentage in the last 15 years, and you've got Stanford at number 5, and you've got Army in the top 20. You've got some, you know, you've got academic institutions that are in there. Here's the other thing. Like, he's trying to say it's because of an agricultural school that they don't play football. Like, that flies in the face of the argument at face value. I would think that the agricultural school should be good at football. Texas A&M is an example. Charlie's in Canby. Charlie, what's on your mind?
Hey, so I believe in Gary Anderson. I do think he's the right guy. But, you know, the one thing Mike Riley always had is that separated him from Oregon was, you know, he was the post-style guy.
Yeah.
He was putting at running backs in the NFL, linemen. And Oregon still does that, but I think Oregon State, in their best interest, would try to get back to that style. And the style that Anderson ran at Wisconsin is separate themselves from Oregon and be, hey, we're going to get you a great education, but we're also going to prepare you for the NFL if you are that good of a player. You know, we run schemes, we run a post-style offense, and we'll get you there. Whereas, you know, Oregon will put up 60 points a game, but a lot of their guys, skill players, you know, obviously Mariota's an exception and some other ones, but, you know, generally speaking, Stanford consistently puts linemen, linebackers, D tackles, you know, they should try to piggyback off that. That's just my idea, to have their own separate identity.
You said the word. That's it. You hit it. I was just going to say, Charlie, identity. That is the word. And look, you only get to hear a bit. You hear a big part of my thoughts on Oregon State on the air. But yesterday was really interesting because we had Mike Leach on the show, and then Leach, I said early in the program, Leach contacted me off air, and he was like, hey, we should do a show together. We've got great chemistry. And we started talking about Oregon State, and he said, you know, I think Oregon State's got good players. And so I ended up on the phone later in the day. I told Gary Anderson, I said, hey, Mike Leach is going to do a show with me. Sorry, you're out. And Gary Anderson and I ended up on the phone yesterday. And I asked exactly what Charlie and Canby is talking about of Gary Anderson. And I said, look, I said, let me just throw this argument out there and you tell me if it's crazy. I said, you aren't going to out-recruit Oregon, USC, even UCLA or Washington, Arizona State. You're not going to out-recruit Stanford for the kind of kids that Stanford wants. So why are you running the same offenses that these other places are running? You're not going to get better athletes. So Oregon State's angle to me is it either has to do something dramatically different than most schools, and everybody's running one back, and everybody's spread in the field, and everybody's trying to get their guys in space. And you can do that to a certain extent if you're Oregon State, but I think they were on the right track with Ryan Nall in the backfield when they're going to pound it at some people and go double tight. And they're going to be physical or maybe pro style. So that is different now. So why not go that route? And he said, yeah, that's a theory. That's legitimate. You can make that argument. But I also think the other thing Oregon State needs to do better than anybody, if they're going to sustain winning, Oregon State has to be a developmental program. Oregon State has to have guys that are starting who are always fourth or fifth year guys in the program. It should not be starting young players every year. Teams that have an influx of talent, an abundance of talent, Alabama, USC, and others, you can start some talent that is young in those programs if they're good enough to play, and everybody goes, oh, those are good players. But if you're starting young players at Oregon State, so you're telling me, A, you're not out recruiting the best schools, and B, you're playing young guys that other schools, you know, didn't have at the top of their list, now you're in real trouble. But if you're playing fourth and fifth year guys at Oregon State, you're at least getting them seasoned to the point where a fourth or fifth year player who might not have, you know, outplayed his counterpart at Oregon, for example, or USC or Stanford or Washington, who might not have outplayed that guy head-to-head as a freshman, give him 3 years, 4 years, 5 years in the program, then turn him loose. I think that's the angle for Oregon State. I think in good seasons, Oregon State will have players that are playing in their fourth and fifth year. I think they'll have a special quarterback. And I think Oregon State's identity offensively has to be something different than what everybody else is running. Try that on. Matt's in Hillsboro. Matt, what do you got?
I think that they need a T. Boone Pickens or a Phil Knight, somebody behind the scenes that's pushing things in a direction, too, and doesn't settle for things.
You need a booster. You need some Oregon State grad that is leaving school this year. Matt, are you a grad at Oregon State?
No, Oregon.
Yeah, see, what Oregon State needs is some kid to invent the next iPhone. Some kid to invent a fertilizer that nobody's heard of that saves the world from hunger. Somebody who has some innovative, great idea that ends up being a multi-billionaire who can come in and go, yeah, you know what? Let's enclose the stadium. Let's put a cryo pool that is bigger than anybody else's cryo pool. I got a cryo pool at my house. Apparently, I found this out from my friends at Anderson Pool Works. They put in the cryo pool at Oregon. They put in the cryo pool at Oregon State. They did the Blazers spas and jacuzzis. They did the swim spa at my house. So I said to Brody and Dana Anderson, I said, hey, when do I get a cryo pool? And they said, you got one, man. All you have to do is put cold water in it. Take your phone calls. If you're an Oregon fan, is it enough what you've seen so far this season to call it a success? Music. Do you have any suggestions for us for bump music? I was going through the bump music, and I was kind of just cycling through the bump music before the show, and I eliminated some things. I put some new things in. Brandon, you're in control over there. How does the bump music show up in the show, your command? What happens on your end?
It honestly just says Canzano music bumps, and I just hit play.
And that's it.
And then, yeah, just a rotation, yeah.
And whatever comes up, comes up.
Right.
Like, if you're going to hit it again, a different song than the one you just played would play?
Yeah, do you want me to try it?
Try it. Let's see what plays. Now, thumbs up or thumbs down on that one? Do we like that one? Gliss says yes. Adriana? Eh. All right, bring that down. Let's try another one. What's the next song that comes up there?
Hold on, I have to get to the end of it here.
Because you have to let it... Oh, you have to let it play out?
Plays it.
It has to play all the way out? Otherwise, it doesn't change over?
Yes, it randomly plays, and you have to let it play the entire cart. There actually is a way that you can open up one of those music carts and actually, you know, select individual songs.
So that's what I did pre-show. So I was going through, and there was some stuff in there that was bad. I mean, it was like old man music, and I thought, I got to get rid of it. Tell me when you're ready to play another one. It might not be ready yet. Bliss says thumbs up. Adriana. Adriana's saying no.
She's going to say that for like all these songs.
All right. Let's see what comes up next. I left that one in there, obviously, because it's still in there. I took out things like there was some Salt and Pepper in there. There was Coolio.
God, I love that song, though. Shoop gets me going.
I got it out of there. Yeah. Nobody wants to hear that on sports radio. Man, that smacks of kind of like 80, like 1990s rock ish guy who's got, you know, it's not, I don't know, is that my guy who's listening to that song?
I think so. I mean, I think it works for the imaging of the show. I mean, even all these songs like that we've played, it's not stuff that I would necessarily be listening to, you know, first thing on my iPod, but I think it works.
I was driving the 14-year-old to school today, and she was playing music and going, what about this one, Dad? What about this one? And about 80% of what she was giving me, I was going, no. But every once in a while, she had one. So I threw a few of her selections in. Adriana had made a suggestion weeks ago. I threw that one in. I picked a couple other ones, but I eliminated about 20 of the songs. Play another one. Wait. If you're playing out of the right vault.
It says Canzano bumps on it.
Try BFT bumps. Is there another folder that's BFT bumps that's in there? I wonder if there's two different ones. I wonder if that's the problem, because remember what, I've had so many board operators. When I went in there, you know how many benchmarks are in there? Like for old benchmarks for the show?
It's pretty bad.
I like it though, because I'm like, oh, you know, I want to keep that one. We used to do one called the Soccer Mom benchmark, or Soccer for Dummies. We had all these benchmarks in there.
Sometimes the male perspective is too much.
Now, come on! What kind of a call is that?
Now, something else. Ya know her.
Thanks, Greg. Thanks, Martha.
Ya love her.
It's so quiet, I can't think.
She's the virtual voice of reason, don't you know?
I thought I heard an argument.
Supplying perspective and worldly advice and answers.
There's something else missing, but I can't think what it is.
Meet the bald-faced truth soccer mom.
And then that proceeded to be soccer moms that would call into the show. That wasn't great radio. But this, not the soccer mom's fault, but it was like, you know.
You know what we should do is just create, and someone on staff had this suggestion before that used to run the board. We should create a separate BFT folder, and then we could downsize it, but you can still keep all the old stuff in the original BFT folder.
Nah, all right. I went back in there, and I like having 10 years of stuff in there. That's the problem is these other folks have been here like 2 months. And they're all going, hey, you got too many things in there. You know what that means, bub? That means that we've been around here for a while. That's like some young guy telling you, hey, you should get Botox. No, you know what those lines are? That means I lived a little, all right? Know what I'm doing over here. What other? Give me another song there, Brandon. It's all right. For the imaging of the show, it's all right. Here's a song that I popped in there earlier that has not propagated yet. It's the Maroon 5 SZA song. This is the one Adriana suggested. And then the 14-year-old gave it major props. Like, I got a lot of cred because I was like, what about this song? And she was like, yeah, I like that. Let me play it here. I got to turn it up. The 14-year-old liked that song?
I don't think so. I think it's okay to have some, you know, stuff that's a little more popular.
You know what I need up the game. You tell you what, you get that song in your head, you're done. It's like Hannibal Lecter. Make you swallow your own tongue.
I used to do top 40 radio at my last job. I was a midday DJ for 3 years in a row. Top 40, if it gets stuck in your head, is the worst possible thing. And that was all day.
I was trying to listen to that song like with the 14-year-old, and then she starts singing. And then she's like, well, Dad, try this one. And then the ride to school was like great because I felt like she was contributing to the show. And I also know, like, okay, she's in high school now. And she said in class the other day, the teacher asked them to raise their hand, and he went person by person, want to know if they're a Duck or Beaver fan, right? It's a problem for her, like different from other kids, because there's going to be a little bit of an issue. If she says she's a Beaver fan, people are going to be like, oh, Canzano's a Beaver fan. She says she's a Duck fan, they're going to be like, oh, a Duck fan. So I guess the teacher was a Beaver fan. And so the teacher came to her and said, well, who do you root for? And she goes, well, I root for the Beavers. And she roots for the Beavers because of Sean Mannion. Because when Sean Mannion was the quarterback, she wanted a Sean Mannion jersey. She liked Mannion. Mannion gave her a shout out. So she was like, okay, I'm a Mannion guy. She's got a Ducks thing at home. But that's her choice. But then the teacher followed it up because the teacher's a Beaver fan. It would assume that I was a Duck fan. That's what the teacher thought, the Beaver fan. Said, well, even though your dad, you're still a Beaver fan? And she was like, well, yeah, what's that got to do with it? So I felt like she was contributing to the show. Play the next bump song. I want to see what we got. Got a lot of songs in there, man. Like, nothing new that I put in there has popped up. You know? It's weird that all those songs are in there. I don't know if we're operating out of the right vault. Is there a BFT bumps?
I looked. There wasn't anything in there.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I typed in BFT bumps.
I have to look in there. Look in there later. All right. One thing I want to call your attention to before we turn this over to the great programming that will follow the show on your station. I want you to be sure of this. If you all will do this, I think it will make your job as a listener and my job as a host complete, because Adriana, Alabama Adriana, does a remarkable job. She was just leaving the room right now. She stopped to hear what I was going to say about her. She does a remarkable job podcasting. Now that she's gone, we can talk. Oh, goodness. What's it like to work down there with Alabama Adriana, Gliss? Just chatting your ear off all show or what?
No, she's a pro.
All right. She's listening still. So here's the bottom line. She podcasts the show. She is one of these people who puts in an incredible amount of time and energy and effort into podcasting the show and making sure that everything is perfect, everything is right. So she goes to the great lengths of doing this. Even when she's off, she ends up saying, you know, double checking to make sure that Gliss did it right or one of the other production assistants did it right. She goes back and she does this on her own time. She's a rare case of a young person who's got tremendous personal pride in what she does. She podcasts the show. She pays attention to the podcast numbers. More people are podcasting than ever before right now. And she knows that about 400,000 people listen to a BFT podcast in a year. Do us a favor. It's free. Subscribe to the Bald Face Truth Radio Show on SoundCloud and iTunes. If you are an Apple phone user, you can download the SoundCloud app. You can get a lot of great content there. Search for the Bald Face Truth Radio Show, John Canzano. Subscribe. It's free. If you are an iPhone user, the Purple Podcast app that you don't really know, maybe some of you don't know what it does, that's the podcast app. Just click on it today, search for Bald Face Truth, and make sure that you subscribe to the radio show. That would make Alabama Adriana's job more fulfilling. I can tell you that because she pays attention to the people subscribing and what that means. The Bald Face Truth, not here for a long time, just a good time. Great programming ahead.